2 weeks before my race was the U.S. Olympic trials, and that kind of lit a fire under me and created this almost intense pressure. Like, I need to make this team. My college teammates just made the U.S. team. I gotta make it. Like, this means so much to me, and I want that. And I was like amped 2 weeks to go.
That was Rory Linkletter, and this is episode 180 of the Inspired Souls podcast. Hi, I'm Carolyn, and I'm a roadrunner.
And I'm Kim, and I'm a trail runner. Welcome to our podcast, where we bring the communities of trail and road running together and explore the parallels between running and life.
Rory Linkletter is a professional Canadian athlete who lives and trains in Flagstaff, Arizona, is sponsored by Puma, and is coached by U.S. half marathon record holder Ryan Hall. He's also now the second fastest Canadian marathoner in history. We first had Rory on the show 6 months ago after finishing 19th at the World Championships Marathon in Budapest. Since then, he's been training up a storm with one goal in mind, making the 2024 Paris Olympic team. Ideally, that meant running the Olympic standard of 2:08:10, which was no small feat considering he'd have to shave over 2 minutes off his personal best. But on February 18th, Rory got the job done in Seville, Spain with 9 seconds to spare, running the race of his life in a new personal best of 2:08:01. In this conversation, we discuss how Rory got fired up watching his former BYU teammates Connor Mance and Clayton Young go 1-2 at the U.S. Olympic Marathon Trials, as well as watching fellow Puma athletes Fiona O'Keefe and Dakota Lindworm secure their Olympic berths. We talk about what Pumas he wore on race day, what it meant to have his family's support in Spain, and what it feels like to run a 1 second negative split. Even though Rory is at the very top of the sport, so much of what he talked about was relatable to the average runner. Just like you and me, he experiences taper crazies in the weeks before a big race, he ceases to be able to do math in the final stretches of a marathon, and he sometimes hesitates to put his big goals out into the world in case he fails to reach them. You'll have to listen to the end to hear about his Olympic marathon dreams this summer in Paris, should he be named to our Canadian team, which we'll know by May 5th. So without further delay, please enjoy our conversation with Rory Linkletter. Today, we welcome back Rory Linkletter to the show. Thanks for being with us again, Rory.
Thanks for having me back on. I must not have been too bad the first time around to be asked back on.
Definitely not. And I'm going to start with a couple little fun facts. We had you on the show for the first time exactly 6 months ago to the day. I looked it up before we started recording. I'm like, it was exactly 6 months ago. So that's pretty cool. And I'll link to that episode in the show notes. But I remember opening by telling you the story of how I met you and Ben Flanagan in an Ottawa elevator the weekend of the Canadian 10K Champs in 2022. And how Kim and I had then gone on to have Ben on the show not once, but twice before ever having you on the show once. So with your appearance today, we can now say that you and Ben are officially tied for your number of appearances on Inspired Souls. So first question, how does that make you feel?
Yeah, I'm glad I have reached the same level of importance. And I don't know. It's great. So Ben's obviously a great friend, as I said in the last time you guys interviewed me. I think we talked about this, but I'll have to let him know that I've tied him. So he's got to do something to get back on, so he can take the lead.
There you go. Well, you are fresh off the Seville Marathon, where you dipped under the Olympic marathon standard by 9 seconds, and became the second fastest Canadian marathoner ever behind Cam Levins. Third fastest time, second fastest person. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, Cam has beaten that time that I ran twice. He did it in Eugene and in Tokyo. So,
Well, huge congratulations. Let's just start there. That performance was just, I'm sure, everything that you could have ever imagined. And we're going to get into every single detail of it today. But just a first off, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it was awesome. I'm very excited. It's 15 days later at this exact moment, and I'm still coming down from cloud nine. Yeah. So it's definitely one of those, like, you know, a long time coming. So it feels kind of silly to move on super fast when it's been years and years in the making. So I'm excited, but I'm also very much a type A athlete type, where I'm already thinking about what's next and everything else. So I'm not, I'm not totally just stuck in Seville mentally. I'm getting ready for what's next, and I'm excited about that stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you need to really soak these things in because they don't happen every day. And I wanted to start by talking about that standard, because I think the last time that we'd had you on the show, your personal best was 210 something, 210.24. Was that your personal best going in?
Yeah, 210.24 from Eugene in 2022.
Right. And at that point, like, that was the race of your life, or maybe you would define Budapest as the race of your life. I'm not really sure. But when the Olympic standard comes out and it's 208.10 and you're a 210.24 guy, let's start there. What's going through your mind when that gets announced?
I definitely had times where that was intimidating and that I was like, wow, why did they do this? And I felt like it was influenced by maybe unrealistic expectations. That's the best way I could put that. And, you know, two Olympics ago, I think the standard in Rio was 216. And one Olympics ago, it was 211.30. Right. So we're on a trajectory for some pretty crazy times in 2028. So I'm glad I hit it for this Olympic cycle, because who knows where the bar will be set the next time we have an Olympics. So
yes,
to me, it is hard. And that's why it's a big deal, because I am one of, I think, 67 people in the world that have hit it. Three per country, obviously. Like, there's like 50 Kenyans that have hit it, and like 45 Ethiopians. And I would be the 25th Japanese runner. Did you know that?
Wow. I did know that Japan is quite serious about their marathoners. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so crazy. that gives you a little bit of humble pie and perspective on things. But yeah, I'm incredibly proud of the time that I ran, because the standard was so difficult.
Yeah. And now, going back to Ben, I don't mean to bring Ben into all of our conversation, but we did talk with Ben about kind of all things world champs. And it's very similar with the Olympics, where you can get in on a time qualifier, but you can also get in by world ranking. Was your plan all along, or first of all, is it the same with the marathon? And if so, was your plan all along to go for the time, or was there like a plan B to try to get in on rankings if the time standard didn't work out for you?
Yeah. So I thought I could run the time. I wasn't certain of that, but I had an amount of my belief was, hey, right day, right conditions, right course, you can do this.
Okay.
But there was definitely a part of me that was planning for a scenario where I didn't hit the time, and I was going into Seville in on rankings based on my Budapest performance and my Houston half marathon that I did earlier this year in this build towards Seville. So I was sitting on the road to Paris list 76th out of 80 people, and the field size is 80. So I knew if I didn't do anything to improve my ranking, I was going to be out, because of the fact that Seville was a good opportunity for multiple people and there's more opportunities coming. So I knew at a minimum I had to improve upon my ranking. So when we talk about the race, I can tell you about how that was in my head as I was racing, because I didn't know if I was going to hit that standard, you know, all the way up until the very end. So there was a lot of things to fight for.
Okay. Well, before we move there, I just wanted to, because for the, you know, everyday runner, I think the best comparison for this is like the Boston Marathon standards, where we have these standards that we need to hit to get into that race. Or I guess for people that are maybe that next level up, it's like that Olympic trials qualifier. And I remember there being such a kerfuffle about, like, for the women anyway, like one Olympic cycle ago, it was 245, and then they lowered it this time to 237, and there people are like, what? Like, if you're close to 245, 237 is like a complete other world away. But I looked at these and thought, my gosh, like 208.10 for like a 210 guy can also maybe feel like that. Could you speak to that just a little bit, and sort of what those particular 2 minutes means, and how you go believing like, I can do that, even when you've never proven that you could do that yet?
Yeah. I would say the fact of the matter is I had never run like a really excellent marathon on a fast course up to that day. Like, Eugene was a good race and I was proud of the time I ran on that day. But for context, it was a 6-week build. I found out I was going to Eugene 45 days before the race. So I wasn't exactly like peaking for Eugene all year round. Whereas like this Seville, there was like a 6-month plan in place. Like post Budapest, it was basically, here's this date, work back from here. And we were very methodical about how we got there. So for one, I was well prepared. Two, based on my half marathon performances of the past, it suggests that I could run that time just because there's plenty of guys that have run 208 that have not run 61 flat. It's just, yeah. And I know the half and the full are very different races, but a part of me is like, if you're prepared well for the full, you have clearly enough speed to run those times. So I looked at it. I looked at that as a confidence booster. It was just like, I know I can run 64 minutes and feel very comfortable, which is with the halfway split for a 208 marathon. So now it's just a matter of how long can I keep it together after that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you've had 6 months to prepare for Seville as opposed to 6 weeks, for example. How was that different than potentially some of your other performances?
Yeah. So I'll take it back to when we decided to do Seville. So I did Budapest in the summer, and then coming off of Budapest, I was fired up, ready to go, ready to chase something big. Cause I'd felt like that was a breakthrough race that didn't show on paper, a 212 marathon in those conditions. I knew what that race was like and I knew how I felt on the day. I was like, man, if the weather was right, I think I could have run a really fast time on that day. So I looked at that and I wanted to go right to the next marathon. I was like, Ryan, let's sign up for Valencia. Let's go like December. Boom. Let's get after it. And he actually pushed back and said, I don't think that's how you're going to run your best marathon. I think we need to take a step back, work on speed again, and then build towards Seville. So,
and that's why we have coaches.
Yes. And that it took faith to trust that he was right. Cause I kind of wanted to ride the wave and take my momentum straight into another one. And I was motivated obviously, but we did that. We took the break after Budapest, did a slow build, started working on our speed and used some races to check along the way on how we were doing. I did the Manchester road race on Thanksgiving, US Thanksgiving. And then a week later, I did a mile where I tried to break 4 for the first time, successfully squeaked under by a second. Yeah. And then I kind of, after that race, switched back into marathon mode, did the half on the route to Seville, ran a personal best there. Another, you know, affirming that I'm on the right path, that I'm in great, great form and things are going well. Yep. So there was kind of these checkpoints along that 6-month build, the reset, the build up, a couple races that were shorter to show, hey, speed's in a great place.
Yep.
The half marathon is like a midway checkpoint. And then now it's all about putting it together on race day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just such a phenomenon that the everyday runner can relate to. It's like, I want to just ride this wave and like do another marathon to prove that I was fit and stuff like that. But what in your understanding is kind of the theory behind getting fast, like sort of doing things in the right order, like take that downtime, build the speed, and then get into another marathon block to potentially build to a higher peak. Is that kind of the philosophy, and have your other coaches subscribe to that as well?
Yeah, I think most coaches know that downtime is an opportunity to reset things. And the way I look at it and the way it's been explained to me is when you come off a big race and you're in peak form, there's not a lot of room to go up from there unless you come down and then start the build again. You kind of have to break things down. You don't have to start completely at zero. You don't have to be in bad shape again, but you have to rest. You have to let your body be in a place where it's ready to go again, where it's in a physiological state to push once again, because these things are emotionally, physically, mentally draining. And even though you're motivated after a race, your body may not be ready to do all that work again without a proper reset. And so more than anything, I think it's about getting the body back in the right place, because you know the mind's always ready to go for most of us. Most of us have the mind and the fortitude to want to work. We're motivated. We have these big goals, but we got to understand how the body works, and the body works really well off of rest and periodization.
Yeah, for sure. And if I'm not mistaken, that was the first time you'd gone under four for the mile?
Yeah, yeah.
How did that feel?
I was pumped. I mean, it's not as big of implications as running the Olympic standard, but it felt like a milestone. Like I was very excited about it. And,
of course.
You know, very similar feelings crossing the line. When I crossed the line for the sub four, I, you know, threw my arms up and let out a roar of excitement, and same thing happened in Seville. So, I mean, if you just watch me finish, there was joy in both experiences, which is really fun, because not every finish line is like filled with just elation, right? Like I was just pumped both times. So,
and was that mile at altitude? Where did you do it?
I did it in Boston. So the fastest track in the world.
Okay.
Not at altitude.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, Rory. So this might sound like a silly trail runner question, but why not do a North American race? Like, why Seville? Why did you have to travel all the way across the pond to Europe for this one?
Okay, there's a couple answers to this. I like this question, first of all. One, there's not a ton of great North American fast races. There's Chicago. It's good. Toronto's all right. Houston's pretty good. And I considered others, but the allure to Seville specifically was two things: fast course, good weather for one. That's part one. And part two is competition. So I don't know if you saw this. I think I put this on my Instagram story last week. Is Seville was this year was the deepest marathon in ever. So 41 men broke 210, which broke a record for the most men under 210 in a race ever. So we know that
the
it helps
trials like this was the race to be at.
Yeah. It's just like on another level as far as the amount of bodies that are out there running very, very fast. And that was really helpful, especially towards the tail end of the race. Cause I put myself in the front of the 208 group. Cause there's a couple pace groups, right? There's the going for the win and the course record group. Then there's usually this other middle group. And then there was our Olympic standard group. Mm-hmm. And my goal was to try to win the Olympic standard group. Cause I figured if I'm the top guy in this group, I'm definitely getting the standard. That was my mentality. And even late in the race, like people are coming back to me that went out hard. There's people like in my group making moves. So there was just like bodies everywhere. And another thing about it is I went to Spain before Budapest for a little training camp, heat adaptation. Athletics Canada had something in Barcelona. And I just loved Spain. I was blown away. And I was like, I want to bring my family here. I want to go back to Spain. So I was looking for a race that fit that. And it just so happens that the two fastest marathons in the world are both in Spain, Valencia and Seville.
Yeah. So, okay. And I can totally see that, because this ran like a time trial almost. Like you had a job to do. You had to get the standard. We want to do that on obviously a flat, fast course and with lots of great competition in the form of a pace group, essentially. So, so it was kind of perfect. So that made the like jet lag and the time difference, all worth it, I guess, to go over there. And do you feel kind of more, do you feel like it's more low key on you? Like not as, like if you go to a Boston or a New York, there's like sponsor obligations and, you know, appearances and things like that. Was it a bit more low key in that sense?
I guess it could be, but no, like, because I knew what I was there to do, it didn't feel low key at all. And you go a long ways and you put a lot of time into it. There is like less pageantry and hype and excitement and all those things around than say a Boston, for example.
Right.
But the bottom line is your goals on the day are what dictate kind of the hype around something. And to me, for 6 months, this was, I'm training for the biggest day of my career, like the one, like a defining moment of my career. So it was huge, obviously. So there was like highs and lows in that, but I feel like I handled everything quite well going in, and it helped a lot to have my family there. We went out a week, basically a week before the race. We got there Monday before the race. So I'd done the European travel thing and I know how much time it takes me to feel good and all the things. So that was another thing why I chose Spain, is I've been to Spain. So I know exactly how to travel there, exactly how to piece it together. And so we had a pretty good plan on how to adjust.
Yeah. And I can imagine it was lovely to have your family there. And I remember what it was like to have a 2-year-old and a less than 1-year-old. Were you guys all sharing a hotel room?
No. So first off, the moment we got to Spain, we went to Boston first, which is kind of like a little weird caveat. We went there to visit Puma headquarters because I had to do some things there and also get 2 hours of the time difference out of the way in the first couple days.
Right.
And then we flew to Spain, but we flew to Spain at like a 6 p.m. flight that got us there like 6 a.m. the next day. And so like when I booked that, I was like, perfect. We sleep on this flight, we get there, Spanish time, ride out that day, and we're right on schedule when we get there. It's not a big deal at all. But toddler didn't sleep on the flight over. First day there was a nightmare, lots of tantrums, lots of fits. And I thought I made a grave mistake on that day. But luckily, we had plenty of time and we were able to rally. And by the end of the week, things were pretty normal for us there. We had an Airbnb, so we weren't sleeping in a hotel room together. That would have been horrible. I got a three bedroom apartment for Airbnbs in Europe are awesome. They're cheap. Oh. They're really quite affordable considering what you get. So we were like right in the city center of Seville, walking distance from everything. And it was like pretty good deal for a 3-bedroom. So pretty awesome. Hey,
well, I think that was smart planning from what I can recall of when my kids were that age.
I've only been to Spain once, but I remember flying a red eye and then sleeping with blackout curtains for 14 straight hours after that with no kids. That was just me a few years ago. So it sounds like you actually, you could have been worse. So by the end of the week, you felt on point.
Yep. And I felt like I was in Spain.
Let's hit on that short trip to Boston for the Puma thing. So weren't you there testing out different shoes? I saw this in your YouTube video.
Yes.
How economical you were in their like 2 varieties of super shoes. So what were the results of that?
Yeah. So Puma is doing such great work with, racing shoes right now and just shoes in general, but specifically what matters the most for us athletes that are sponsored by them is what we can wear on race day. Right.
Yep.
And they had 2 really good options available to us, the Deviate Elite 3s, which was worn by Fiona O'Keefe and Dakota Lindworm at the US Olympic trials, who made the team.
Yep.
And then there was the Fast R2, which I had raced Houston in, I had raced Manchester Road Race, and I had been training in for the most of the block. But I got the Deviate 3s about a month before Seville and did a lot of workouts in them, and they were both great. And I was like, okay, this would be really helpful to know what shoe I'm better in, you know, because I felt comfortable in either. I felt like I could have run the race in either. Say I packed both and realized I'd packed 2 lefts of one and had to race in the other, I would have been completely fine with it, right? But it's fun to know, hey, what shoe am I more efficient in? That's something I've been really curious about because I've heard of other people doing that test. And Puma had done that with other professionals. And I was like, can I do this?
Did you have a sense, like having tried them both, were you like, my gut, if I had to guess, would say one or the other?
Yes. But not so much from my experience in the shoe as witnessing what other people were choosing and basing similarities across it. So basically the pattern I was noticing is men were choosing the Fast R2 and women were choosing the Deviate Elite 3. And specifically, not just men, like that's a generalization. But I think there's like the difference between striders and gliders. That's the term that Puma uses. So people that glide gently over the ground and are soft on their feet, those are gliders. Those are people that would gravitate maybe more towards the Deviate Elite 3 because of the way it's built. It's light. It's doesn't feel like anything other than a traditional flat, but with the nice foam and the plate and all those things that you need. Whereas the Fast R2 is kind of like this propulsion machine, but you need to load it. You need to, you need to stride into it. You need to like put a ton of force into this shoe to get the propulsion back out of the shoe that it's designed for. If you're not putting a lot of force into the, those plates and the shoe itself, I feel like what it's designed to do is not being accomplished. So knowing that I felt like I was more of a strider, and you know, I'm not a small marathoner. I'm a larger elite marathoner on like the world class stage, right? So I kind of figured, hey, I'm a strong stride type guy. I'm probably going to be better in the shoe that seems to favor those types of athletes.
Okay, and then what did the results say from your metabolic testing?
Very negligible difference. So okay. I was pretty good in both. Well, really good in both. And the difference was half a percentage point in running economy, which is not statistically really that significant. Mm-hmm. So I could have, in theory, been like, you know what, I'm just going to trust the Deviate Elite 3, and it probably wouldn't have made a big difference, because the misconception here is that half a percent is half a percent of time. It's not. It's half a percent of metabolic output, running economy, whatever. I don't understand it fully, but it doesn't translate to seconds. Like, it's not like I cut half a percent off my time, right?
But you know, this matches, sorry to interrupt for a second.
No, you're good.
Other guests we've had on the show and discussions we've had about, you know, the more mechanically efficient runner you are, the less the shoe matters, right? Like, at the end of the day, good running economy is good running economy. And it's really interesting to hear that it was half a percent difference on really what you're describing as a fundamentally very different shoe. So
yes,
here's my question. Why did you choose the Deviate 3s? Is it just because you had been running in them previously? You were comfortable with them, or what was it? What was that decision point for you?
So I chose the Fast R2s because...
Oh, sorry. I got that wrong.
Yeah, okay. No, you're good. I mean, we're talking, these names are just like, yeah, these are new names, okay. Right? So I chose the Fast R2s because I was indifferent and I figured half a percent's better than nothing. So I was ready to let the test completely dictate what was going to happen. And I kind of hoped and thought that the test would tell me that it was going to be Fast R2. So, and it did.
Because there was really no wrong answer. And it was slightly better from your testing and also maybe psychologically too.
Well, I was just going to say, if you believe in it and you really trust it, that's got to mean something too, right? So
And I had raced, I would just add, I raced in the Deviate 2 in my last three marathons. So like the Deviate was a comfort. So I knew if I had to fall back on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
The threes and the twos were similar enough that it would have been a comfort. So.
Okay. Okay, so no wrong answer. So we got the shoes, we got everything, you're over there. Race morning comes. Describe like how you were like mentally. Were you nervous? Were you excited? Like, what was the weather like that day? Just sort of paint us a little picture of race day.
Yeah, I would say the way I work is I get all my like nervous energy out in the weeks leading up to something. And by the time the race rolled around, I felt pretty calm. It was perfect conditions. For some reason, maybe somebody with time zone expertise could tell me this, but the sun doesn't rise in Spain till like 8:15 in the morning. And I don't understand why this happens. Cause that's not how it's happening. You'd think time zones, it's all just like, you know, 8 o'clock is the same everywhere in the world. Like it's to some extent.
Time zone is. If you're on the western edge of the time zone and it's a huge time zone, it will be later, right? Yeah.
That's probably what it is. But I was very thrown off first off. That was the hardest adjustment, was that the sun didn't rise till 8. So I was sleeping in till like 8:30 every day. And the race was at 8:30. So get up, it's dark as we're warming up, as we're getting out there. It's crisp but not cold. Like, you could have been in like a light jacket standing on the side not running and feel very comfortable. I think it was like 9 degrees Celsius, 48 Fahrenheit when the gun went off, and then it rose to 12 degrees Celsius or 53 degrees Fahrenheit or whatever by the end of the race. So pretty ideal conditions. It was like nice, not a lot of wind. Pretty perfect morning. Yeah. So can't
like
complain.
The opposite of Budapest.
Yeah. It was like, we're not talking, it's not even the same sport, it feels like, at that point. So.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, so as you're kind of prepping for this race, I'm wondering about that week before. Like, do you get the taper crazies like us normal people do, or is it something that doesn't affect you?
I would say I probably get it as bad or worse. But I think it's different every time. So I've had some marathons where it's pretty mellow and it's not like a lot going on and there's not any sort of catastrophe that I'm trying to put out, you know, fires I'm trying to put out. But this time, I think there was a little bit of fires being put out the whole 2 weeks before the race. And I'm not sure if it was physical, mental, whatever. I trained really hard up until 2 weeks before. Like, I had my biggest weeks like in between Houston and the taper. So Houston was 5 weeks prior. So I did three really hard weeks and then a 2 week taper. And I feel like I really pushed those 3 weeks. Like, I went to the edge. I don't know if that was just like the way it was designed or if that was the way I was approaching it or whatnot. But I came out of the last hard week and I was like, I nailed it. It was perfect. But then I was like, I may have, you know, done a little bit too much there. And I was dealing with a couple niggles in my legs. I had like left knee pain. I had back pain. I had this and that, like a little bit more than I was comfortable with. Like, I was able to run through it, but I was one of those things where it's like on your mind. You're like, is this going to affect the race? Is this going to ruin the race? And 2 weeks before my race was the US Olympic trials. And that kind of lit a fire under me and created this almost intense pressure. Like, I need to make this team. My college teammates just made the US team. I gotta make it. Like, this means so much to me and I want that. And I was like amped 2 weeks to go. And so I kind of went through all these like mental barriers of like, oh, am I ready? Is this going to happen? Like, kind of fear. And then like, as the race got closer, the fear dwindled, the confidence grew. You know, I had a couple waves of fear about was my body going to be ready traveling over from the flight. I had like back tightness the whole week of the race. And I was like freaking out that my back was going to lock up in the race. So yes, to answer your question, crazy stuff was happening the whole last 2 weeks for a number of reasons, the travel, the training, just the psychological warfare.
Yeah. On that note, psychological warfare, do you work with a sports psychologist? Like, do you have anybody that helps you through all this or?
I work with a psychologist. He's not a sports psychologist, but I have been working with an 80-year-old man named Bert Gershiter that I started working with at the end of 2021, middle of 2021. And we've been working together now for, I guess it's, you know, 3 years almost now. So, and he's been helpful more so as like a person than it is like an athlete. Like, I don't talk to him a ton about like, well, what should I do on race day? Like, how should I, you know, zen out? How should I get in the zone? You know, cause I've tried that and I think we all know how to do that. I think it's more important that you're just a healthy person, you know, than it is like working on your like mental game. I just need to be happy, healthy, and in the right frame of mind and have the right perspective more than anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, it's good to know that you're human.
Yeah. There you go.
And very relatable again. But let's move into just walking through the race. So the gun goes off. What happens in the first half? Like, are you immediately with this 208.10 Olympic standard group or what happens there?
Yeah, I put myself right at the front of that group. And that was kind of the mentality as in the past, I would have probably put myself in the back and tried to be as conservative as possible and, you know, out of fear more than anything. But I've learned a lot about myself and I know myself and I know that I'm best when I'm really engaged with something. You know, a lot of marathoners like to almost zone out is how they would describe it. Like, don't even turn on your brain till 30K or whatnot. I'm the opposite. I want to be engaged the whole time. I want to be in it, in the throes, thinking, just like feeling like I'm just so dialed in from the gun. And that's what I did. I put myself in the front of the group and I told myself, win this group, you make the Olympics. It was what I was telling myself, right? I just went through that and felt great. The first 10, 20K ticked by just like really without any sort of hiccups or any sort of fears or doubts. It was just kind of flying by that first half. And then the race begins. You start running harder splits and stuff like that.
Does your group, though, have a pacer, or are you, by virtue of being at the front of the group, kind of like the pacer of that group? Like, you're not having to check splits in that sense and wasting energy that way, are you?
So I was checking them because I was not confident in our pacer, which we did have one, and he was fine. He was fine, but you generally don't want to leave too much up to the pacers, because I had heard in years past, like, hey, pacer was 20 seconds slow at half, or they can sometimes be 20 seconds fast. So you want to keep tabs on it. And everyone in that group was keeping tabs on it. So I didn't really need to be that on top of it. But I do remember multiple times being like, you're good to the pacer. Cause he would slow down thinking like, oh, do I need to keep these guys with me? He would check his shoulder. Like, it seemed like he was very aware of like what we were doing. And I was just like, go. Like, I would talk to this guy. I was like, go, like, just run, like, faster. Like, and I was not the only person doing this. He got really annoyed around 25K, because basically the group was getting really antsy and telling him to speed up. And he's like, we're on pace. He's like getting mad at us. He's yelling at us. And like, I at that point did take the lead of the group. And I was like, I passed our pacer at 25K. And I was like, I'm feeling good. Like, at this point I'm racing. I'm not worried about this guy. And like, yeah, I'm going to just run the pace that feels good for me right now. And that was like 301s, three flats ish at that point. Wow. And I was kind of running the fastest splits of the race and feeling great doing it. So that was that was probably my favorite part of the race, because that was when I was like, okay, we're having a good one now. Like, we're deep enough in this. Things are going well. I'm taking control. Like, that's, like I said, I was engaged with it.
You were so engaged.
It was it was fun.
And they say, I mean, it's such a famous thing, like, oh, the marathon starts at 20 miles or, you know, 32K or somewhere around there, right? Is that where you kind of felt like, okay, like, I'm, you know, I'm on pace, I'm excited, I can do this? Or where did you feel like the race really started for you?
Yeah, so in my training notes, so Ryan sends like Apple Notes, so like the notes app on your phone, like that's how we do our training. So it's like a shared notes app.
Sophisticated.
Yeah, each day has like the workout or whatnot. And for workouts, it'll usually like have details of like splits or like what kind of zone you're going for or whatever. It can be as descriptive or non-descriptive as you could imagine. But for the race, he'll put things in there too, right? And for this race, he put 20 miles at 208 pace and then 6x1 mile all out. It's like kind of like how he was like, so he was basically like, get to 20 and then race every mile after that.
Oh,
right. Like,
gosh.
that was his mentality. And in our talks before, he's like, we know you can run 20 miles at this pace. Like, there's zero doubt. So just get there, just get to 20 and then just race every mile till the finish. And that's kind of was my mentality. And it went according to that plan. Like, I got to 32K feeling like I was still on it and still had fight left in me. And then I got to 34K, 35K, 36K. And then it was like, okay, I think I remember specifically around 36K being like, I've still got 6K to go and some change. And it's getting really hard. So now I've got to take it 1K at a time, one step at a time, really.
Yeah. You got to run the mile you're in.
Yeah. I focused on racing, really. I was like, just stay with the guys that are making moves and that are going for it. Cause like I said, at the onset of the race, win your group, you're going to the Olympics. So I was like focused on just racing the people around me.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a good strategy.
Yeah. I think it suited my strengths. That's why it was good. Cause it just, I don't think I'm a time trialer. Like, that was not my comfort zone, was to run a time trial. I wanted to race. Like, I wanted to feel like a race. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was happening with your group at this point? You started with a fairly big group, but you said you were at the front of it. So were you kind of aware of what was happening behind you, or how many people are still together at this point?
I led probably the most of the non-paced part of the race with that group. Like, once I passed that pacer, I became the pacer in a way. Like, people just followed me, right? So from 25 to 32K, I basically stayed in the lead without anyone else touching it. So like a pretty substantial stretch of the race. And then people started, you know, they hit their 32K, and that's when they like kind of were like, oh, I've got my green light to start pushing. And then it was kind of like roulette. people were going to the front, going to the back, going to the front, but I was never worse than four or five guys in front of me out of that group. And I just kind of followed whatever moves felt real, felt like they made sense, that didn't take me too far out of my comfort zone, and just kind of focused on keeping those guys in arm's reach. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple dudes that were throwing in some good stuff. And I was like, is this a move? Are we speeding up? Are we maintaining? You know, every now and then you get like a 5 meter gap between you and a couple guys. You're like, am I dying? Or is this it? Is this the moment where it all comes crumbling down? But then I would just rally. And I kind of realized now, looking back, like they were probably surging and I was just kind of locked in. So I ended up keeping them at arm's length and then having a good fight the last 1200 meters. So,
okay. So to speak of a good fight, was there ever a time you thought that 208.10 was slipping away?
Absolutely. The whole last 5K, I was convinced. I seriously couldn't do math anymore. For some reason, the
Relatable.
Splits meant nothing. Yeah, the splits meant nothing. They meant nothing that I was seeing, because I wasn't hitting split. I was just kind of like checking in, and I had my watch on like auto lap every 5K. And so it became very confusing just by nature. I would look at my watch when I'd go over a K mark and kind of like work backwards and like, but that like 195 meters at the end just makes it impossible for you to, like, do I add 30 seconds? Do I add 40 seconds? Like, I don't know. Like I kind of got lost in it. So with 5K to go, right when I said, you know, 6K to go, it started getting hard. 5K to go, I think I thought to myself, no matter what, you just gotta fight to the finish, just do the best you can, and just kind of like get everything you can out of yourself here at the end and keep it together, really. Like my biggest fear was like an absolute catastrophic meltdown. And like, not only do I not get the standard, but I don't get the race that reflects the fitness, that reflects the performance I was on track for at that point. So there's a lot of self-preservation in the last 5K of a marathon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether that be how you carry yourself through the course and, or how you respond to certain things and you're kind of analyzing how you feel. I was just so in my body and in my surroundings that it felt like it was slipping away, because it was so hard that it wasn't until 1200 meters to go that I thought, oh my gosh, I can actually do this. Like 41K hit. And I was like, I did the math that, and I was like, I think I need to run 340 to hit it. And I was like, that's the pace I was running all race, but I have no idea what I'm running now. Right.
Yeah.
Like I could be running slower than 310 per K. I could be crawling. Cause like, to me, the pace just felt so intense, cause I was just so on that line. So I just kind of did something that Ryan has had me do in the past. Like at the end of marathon workouts, every now and then he'll have me go through my gears, is what he calls it. So like every like 400 meters, you just kind of like push a little bit more, go like one step further into the gears. And with 1200 to go, that's a very safe way to go. So you push, settle, push, settle. And then once you get to that last bit, it's kind of like a sellout. Like, you know what you've got left. You're probably not going to implode in the last 400 meters unless you like were absolutely foolish out there.
Yeah.
And it wasn't till I hit 42K and could see the clock that I was like, oh my gosh, I think I might be able to do this. So I went into like absolute berserk mode, like hip to ear, like I was running an all out mile. And
it looked like you were running an all out mile. Like, can I just say, like, it looked like you were absolutely flying over the finish line. It was unbelievable.
So I did pass four people in the last 200.
Wow.
I was moving at like a pretty good clip, and I was really proud of that. But also there was two things at play. I didn't want to miss it by like a second. That was going to be devastating. And I didn't know how close I was. But also a soft goal was also to break 208. And if that's in the cards, I've got to empty the tank here to see if I can do that. And I thought I was going to do it until like I just crossed the line, and I thought I ran 208.00. And that was my unofficial time at first.
Yeah.
And that's for a number of reasons was a bummer. And then when it corrected to 208.01, I was like, oh, well, at least I didn't miss it by that small of a margin.
Yes, exactly. Okay. There's so many things I want to go to now. So we need to talk about your wife right now, Jill. So okay. International Absolutely. Women's Day, at the time we're recording this, it's coming up next week, but by the time this comes out, it'll have just happened. But either way, that woman got around the course with two small children and saw you four times. And her, it actually had me in tears, the way she was screaming at you at the end, just like the love and the passion in her voice as she was screaming to get you like every last like millisecond across the finish line was just awesome. Like it gives me chills. But she also saw you somewhere else. I assume it was much earlier on. And she was yelling something at you. It sounded like water.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
What does that mean?
That was at 34, 35K Plaza de España, kind of like the iconic portion of the course that honestly, it could have gone without. I love the Seville Marathon, but that was like the hardest part of the race because they run you into this plaza just to show you how beautiful it is, which it's in breathtaking, beautiful building. But you basically take like five turns in like 500 meters. Uh-huh. You're like doing like all these turns to get into this area. And at this point in the race, your legs are dead. So yeah. it feels horrible, but she was yelling be water, or like water or whatnot. And that's because that's something Ryan tells me to do, because I'm an emotional person. So being like water and letting it flow and like not like responding to everything, that's kind of like something Ryan has told me, and it stuck with me. I really, really like that. It just kind of reminds you to kind of like just kind of like let it flow out of you, like be natural almost. Like if you watch water, you know, flow down a river, it just kind of no matter what's in its path, it just kind of moves. It keeps moving. So she yelled that. I don't remember if I heard that during, but it was pretty cool to hear that in the footage that she got, and that ended up on the YouTube. Jill was everywhere on that course, and I did look forward to seeing her. I saw her at that point. I don't know if I remember hearing her, but I remember because I told her where to be. I gave her like a map of plans. Like I knew you could get to this place at this time. Like the course was spectator friendly, so I was like, be here. This is how much time you have to get there. Like kind of how I broke it down. And so every time I knew she was going to be where she was going to be, I was like, that was what I was running towards in a lot of ways, because you know, the marathon is tough and you checkpoints are great. So I was like, okay, just get to Jill again, get to the next spot. And that'll be a checkpoint along the journey. And that was kind of like the crunch time moment, right? Like that's when the race is real. The first two times she saw me, it was easy at that point. It was in the first 20K of the race. It was like, if I wasn't doing well at that point, something horrible had happened. So,
right.
Yeah.
So that must have meant a lot to you to have her and your kids there at that race. Can you speak to that for a moment?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way I see it is, one, I brought them because I'm not the kind of person to be in Spain alone for a week before a race. That would have been torture to me. So I wanted their emotional support and their company leading up to the race. But more than anything, I didn't want to run a race that I had been building towards for my life and not have the people that are the most important to me there to celebrate it or to pick me up when I was in pieces. Like there was two doors that could have been open there. Like I could have been devastated I could have been.
Yeah. And either way you need them.
Yeah. And either way you want them, you want to share that moment with them because they are the reason and the biggest piece of this puzzle. So it was so special to have them there. And I remember the first thing I did, because I, you know, the finish line's chaos. So I go to my phone, which we had like this tent off to the right of the finish line for the elite athletes, like our bags. And I find my phone and I call Jill. I'm like, where are you? And she's like, I'm stuck on the other side of the finish line. And I'm like, I climbed up to this fence on the other side of the finish line and was like trying to get her to find me. And she finally was able to get around to me. And it was just like, she was just screaming and excited. And I was just smiling ear to ear. And, you know, it was just a happy moment to have that. Like it would have been pretty boring and sad to just be like, well, that was cool. Nobody's here. Everybody in North America is asleep still, you know, like, it was like necessary. So I'm really happy that they were there.
Oh my gosh. That's so awesome. So you finished in a 208 2:01. So again, we said at the beginning, 9 seconds to spare on that 2:08:10. But I'm obsessed with like race execution a little bit. And your splits were like 1:04:01 and 1:04 flat.
Insane.
Like it doesn't really get any more perfect than that. Insane. Does it? Have you ever run a perfectly even split, but technically negative split like that ever before in your life?
Budapest was very similar. I think Budapest was within 10 seconds, which to me, the room for error, like to me, an even split's a negative split and a positive split by under 30 seconds, it might as well be an even split because there's the attrition you feel in the last 10K, you can have paced it perfectly and your legs may just naturally slow. Part of me, because I paced it so evenly, is like, man, I probably left 30 seconds out there. That's generally how I feel. Cause I think if you get every bit out of yourself, and I felt like I got every bit out of myself, I ran as hard as I could all the way to the line. But if you get every bit out of yourself, you should probably feel a little bit of that, like coming undone, and that should reflect in the pace. I don't know if that's 100% accurate because the world record in the men's was set by someone who negative split. So it's like, is that true? I don't know. I just, in my head, it's like, if I'd gone out 20 seconds faster, could I have ran 10 seconds faster?
Right.
Would I slowed a little bit more, but I would have still, you know, had the end time be a little bit better. So I'm curious about that. And I don't know what the perfect execution is of the race, but I know I executed well enough on the day. And I can promise you, I didn't think I was running perfectly even splits. I thought I was just running. I thought I was just running really hard for a long time. So it just happened to shake out that way. I do think I've got a good feel for marathon pace at this point and marathon effort, which is something I've preached a couple times, is like effort is more important than pace. So like, I felt like I nailed the efforts throughout the race.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think you started alluding to this before, but like the 01 part of it, like if you were 2:07:59, you could call yourself a 2:07 marathoner, but now you're a 2:08 marathoner. And then back to the like US trials and Connor Mance and Clayton Young, and they were teammates of yours, weren't they, at BYU? And Clayton Young, didn't he run 2:08 flat in Chicago? Yep. So he technically is 1 second faster than you. So that doesn't bother you, does it?
It doesn't at this. I mean, it does for myself. Like it bothers me because had I run 2 seconds faster, there's a couple reasons why that would have been a little bit sweeter. So, but not necessarily because Clayton ran 2:08 flat. Like that would have been a little cherry on top. I might have given him a playful jab about that or something, but that wasn't weighing on me when I saw my finish time as much as it was like 2 seconds faster has some implications. So, it's also just, it's cool to break a barrier. It just feels like it feels so much sweeter to say 2:07:59 than it does to say 2:08:01.
Is that funny?
It's silly, but that's just how we work, right?
Yeah.
Numbers mean a lot to us, but I am proud nonetheless. And it still is up to this point, the highlight of my career. We're not splitting hairs here.
Don't minimize it in any way. I mean, who decided that a minute is 60 seconds? Okay, maybe a clock, but still.
Time is a construct.
Yeah, it's a construct. Yeah.
It is a construct. Okay, well, let's talk about Paris. Like, does this mean you're going to Paris? Like, currently, I think we just have like one person on the men's side, Cam Levins, named to the team, but you've run this standard. What happens next? How do you officially get onto that Canadian marathon team?
Yeah. So had I run Seville 3 weeks earlier, I would have been named to the team and it would have been done deal official because there was a selection date that I think was the 31st or 30th or something of January, some date in the end of January. And Seville was obviously second weekend of February. So had I run that exact time a month prior, I would, have flights booked for the family. It would be as done of a deal as possible. But since I did it 2 weeks later than the cutoff. Now we're in like phase two of this window that Athletics Canada has created, and the world has created this window, right? So mm-hmm. World Athletics gave people up until May 5th to qualify. That's the end of the qualification window for everybody in the world, no matter what country. Mm. So now it's a waiting game. I'm in a really good spot. I did what I wanted to do. I did what I needed to do to be in a position to go. Now it's out of my hands. If two Canadians run 207.59 and 208 flat and leapfrog me and I'm the fourth man, it's still up to selection because there's some ambiguity to how Canada selects the team. They said that they would consider a body of work. They would weigh in world championship performance. And I think I've done everything I can to put my best foot forward. So now it's like, I know I deserve to be on the start line. Mm-hmm. Now, if two people deserve it more than me at the end of the day, I would salute them and mm-hmm. wish them the best and hope that we're sending the three best possible athletes to Paris. And I hope to be one of those, and I feel ready to be one of those. And I'm acting as if, and in the frame of mind that I will be. So that's kind of how I view it right now.
So we're going to assume that you are going to Paris. What are your goals for that event?
Yeah. This is something that I haven't been shy about on other interviews, and I won't be shy about here. And it's because I've realized in the past, I've been scared to share my goals because then you feel like this public accountability. Like if I don't do it, I'm a failure. Like people will be like, oh, you said you were going to do this and you failed. But, you know, but like, that's not real. That's just like your brain playing tricks on you. And I think I do best when I'm bold about what I want to do. And so I've set the goal to be top 10 in the Olympic Games. And I think that that's a stretch goal that's going to take a good day. But I think it's also not out of this world. Like it's possible. It's totally possible. So that's kind of the stepping stone that I think is the most appropriate for me and would get me excited and will keep me engaged late in the race. You know, I could tell you I want a medal. And of course, if the opportunity presented itself, who doesn't? That's the ultimate pinnacle of the sport.
No.
But I think for where I'm at in my career, a top 10 finish at the Olympic Games would be huge. It would be, it would be massive. And it would be something that I could, if my career ended after that day, like say that's the last run I ever do, I think that'd be a pretty cool way to end it. So that's kind of how I view it.
Okay. Well, for people that may not have spent as much time looking at the course in Paris as I have, it is very hilly and it's in the summer, so it's going to be presumably quite hot. Do you think those kind of conditions play into your favor or not so much?
Yes. They do. I mean, I know I can run good marathons in the heat. I've done it now and I love hills. So, and I know I can train well on the hills. I haven't proven I can race well on a hilly marathon, of course, just by virtue of the fact that I haven't done that in a while, but, knowing what I know about myself and the athlete I've been throughout my career and in training, I'm not scared of a hilly course. I welcome things that can make other people make mistakes, and I trust my ability to execute more than anything. You know, there's the physiological side of running hills, but there's the side of like, I've become capable of knowing where my lines are in the marathon quite well. And knowing your effort is so important on undulating terrain and difficult conditions. And I feel really good about like knowing how to not step over that line.
Yeah.
Well, last time you were on our show, you had some trail running aspirations. And I'm wondering, maybe some trail running might prepare you for Paris.
It will. And it will be a part of my training. I will be running a lot of vert. Today, I did a 90-minute medium long run, whatever you want to call it, kind of the first decent run back of in duration. And Ryan said, run somewhere hilly on a trail, but not too hilly. That was basically he like gave me a cap on how much elevation I could do. So I ran exactly as much as he allowed. So I ran, speaking in feet, 900 feet of vert. He said under 1,000 feet. So I ran up to nine. So I will be doing a lot of vert in training just because that's what I like to do. That's what I do when I'm not training for a hilly race, but I will turn the volume up on the hills, and we'll be looking for opportunities to callus the legs and work those muscles extra hard this summer.
Oh, excellent. You don't hear too many people. Well, maybe Kim in your world you do, but say like, I just love hills. for breakfast, hills for lunch. Like, that's awesome. And you live in Flagstaff and then you've got lots of hills around there. So that's exciting. I've mentioned it once or twice throughout this interview, but you have this YouTube channel and you produce maybe you have some help with it. I'm not sure, but really high quality like productions. Like I just watched a 33-minute YouTube video on this race from you and it was excellent. Like what made you want to start a YouTube channel and maybe tell stories in like a bit of a longer form?
That's the draw is the long form content. Mm-hmm. And the inspiration on this is one of my best friends kind of blew up on YouTube like overnight. Like he's like really good running YouTuber. His name's Adam Wood. Okay. We were high school teammates, college teammates. And now he's got like, he's only been doing it for like 6 or 7 months and he's got almost 50,000 subscribers. He's like making a living on YouTube.
Wow.
And it's like really cool to see what he's done in this space. And he was in Flagstaff this fall. And I was like, man, I gotta follow in your footsteps. I gotta try this. And I was like, oh, but how do I do it? And like making all these excuses for why I couldn't do it. And I didn't have the time, this or that. So basically I came up with this plan, like, hey, I know a lot of people that work in the like media world and like the video production and have a lot of talent. And I was like, I don't have the time to do this, but I can be the talent. I can talk and I can do that. And then I can just turn everything over to someone who's way more qualified to produce the content and piece it together than me. And I chose this guy named Scott Barker here in Flagstaff. He's a young kid, just graduated college, works for NAU in media. And I'd worked with him a few times on some smaller projects over the years. I thought he'd be a perfect fit because he's still kind of establishing himself in this world, but he's very talented and very ambitious. And I thought, hey, I can pay you good money to do this. I can give you good exposure if we do this well, and hopefully this will lead to mutual benefit for us. And so far he's been enjoying it. I've been enjoying it. And I think we're going to keep doing it. Well, I know we're going to keep doing it through at least the Olympic Games. But at this point, I feel like I've invested in this and committed to it, that it's probably going to be just a part of my journey as an athlete, just like sharing this through this medium. Because it's special. It's been fun. I've gotten such good feedback and it's been really cool because I was really scared to do it. Because if you flop on this, I feel like it was like, it's like leaving you pretty exposed. But if you can succeed on it, you can really show people a lot more about yourself than you can on an Instagram post or a Strava caption
or
whatnot.
It's kind of like what you were saying before. Like I was always scared to put my goals out there, but you know, maybe it was your 80-year-old psychologist that encouraged you to just throw it out there and you never know. And being exposed isn't the worst thing always, right? Like when you're exposed, you can connect with people a little bit more and on a deeper level. And I don't know, I love it. I've watched a few of the videos that you have and they're very well done. So maybe plug the channel and any other social media that you want to point people to if they want to follow along as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's just my name on YouTube. Just type in Rory Linkletter. I think I'm the only one of those out there right now. So
yeah,
until further notice. Yeah. That's definitely the one that I'm pushing the most right now, because that's what I'm putting the most effort into. And I think that gives people the realest view of myself. I'm not even in charge of what comes out, right? Like I just talk in front of a camera, get asked questions, let people follow me with cameras or whatever it is. It's kind of like documentarian style. I'm not like behind the scenes, like telling him, I'm not like telling him what to not include and to include. And sometimes I don't even have time to watch it before I just tell him, just post it. So I actually, like there's been multiple times where I'm like, he'll ask me, do you want to watch it before I post? I was like, I don't have time, just post it.
Yeah.
So it's his interpretation of behind the scenes stuff, and he's done me justice thus far, and I trust him. So it's been really cool.
Well, you know, one of my favorite quotes, I don't know, of 2024 and previous is, a question never asked is an automatic no, right? And if you aren't able to ask what's possible, it's always going to be a no. But what if it's a yes? And you've opened up for the yes answer in so many areas of your life, whether it's running and YouTube, and it's really exciting to hear your story and what's potentially going to happen next. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Rory, you're just always so fun to talk to and so fun to cheer for. And we can't wait to follow along on what's next. But we're just going to put it out into the universe that it's going to be the road to Paris. So can't wait to hear. And maybe we'll have to have you on for a part three before Ben Flanagan.
Yeah. Well, how about this? I think Ben Flanagan and I are racing in Ottawa this year again. The winner gets back on the podcast.
Okay. Deal.
Let's have you both together. That would be
Yeah. Yes, that would be great. Okay, we'll follow up after that. So you'll do the 10K in Ottawa?
Yeah, that's the plan right now. So great. I have a couple races lined up, but that's one that I'm excited about quite a bit. So
okay, stay tuned. You heard it here first, folks. Thanks again, Rory.
Thank you.